Hi everyone. Welcome back to Woman's Splain. Today we have a very special guest, Sophia Chang. She is a CEO and founder of Oddball, a new and innovative company in the food space that just launched last week. I'm gonna pass over to her to do a little intro and then we'll dive into her story.
Thank you for having me today. I'm super excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you.
So Oddball, so we are a new type of family snack brand. So think of us as next generation of hopefully one day, you know, like next Mars or next Ferrero, etc. Really looking to bring like clean, accessible, healthy foods to everybody. And we are inspired by Asian principles of eating. So minimally processed, real food based eating.
Awesome.
Well, I know you have a really incredible background even before you dived into the food space. So let's start from where are you from and where did you grow up?
Absolutely. So I am from Singapore and Hong Kong. So I spent most of my childhood in both places. I had actually wanted to be a journalist growing up.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah, I that's a little bit of a fun fact about me. I wanted to become an investigative journalist. I was interning, you know, at the Associated Press and Wall Street Journal. I worked there my senior year of college. But ultimately, you know, I decided to, I wanted to stay in the US, right? So I had very limited career path choices. It was really just consulting or finance, which are two great career options too. And ultimately decided to go into management consulting first. So I worked at Kearney. I left and I joined Bridgewater Associates, which is the world's largest hedge fund. Worked with the family. So I worked for Ray's family. And that was kind of my first introduction into VC, private investments, early stage investings, and entrepreneurship. And eventually I left because the commute was just a little bit too crazy for me. It was, you know, between New York and Westport, I think we talked about this, right? Where I had a 4-hour commute every single day.
To clarify, it was basically, Bridgewater is located basically in a suburb of New York City in Connecticut. It's like probably an hour plus on the train. So it's really tough to do the reverse commute and live in the city.
Yeah. So it was a 4-hour commute every day, but it was
four hours.
Two there, two back.
Yeah, right. Two there and two back.
So it was, I guess, in deeper Connecticut than I thought.
Yeah, okay. It's in Westport. So.
Yeah, Westport's far.
Westport's very far.
It's far.
And you guys had a car, right? Like
they had a bus that picks you up. So, you know, woke up at 5 a.m. ish, and we're out the door by like before 6 a.m. Right, and
then that's so rough.
Yeah, then you come back around 9 p.m. and then you had to go to bed, right?
Because like it's
the same thing again. And I just realized, you know, I also couldn't, I can't drive, right? It was just, you know, logistically, I was spending way too much time on a bus.
Yeah.
So eventually I left and I joined Estee Lauder Companies as a strategy director. Also because my old boss in consulting became the global head of strategy and transformation at Estee Lauder. So that's a little bit about my background.
Great.
That's awesome.
Did you always know that you wanted to move closer to the consumer space, or was it kind of luck that your old boss was at Estee Lauder?
You know, I think in the beginning of your career, right, like, or when you're, you know, I think at that point I was in like the beginning and I've tried a few things. I think it's about trying things that you don't dislike, right? So I think it's this process of elimination of trying things of like what you like and what you didn't like. And consumer was a space that I didn't know whether I liked, but I knew I didn't dislike, right? So I think that was what attracted me to it, that I also wanted to learn how to be an operator, right? I think, you know, being more from the investment side of things so young, I wanted to get like more hands-on experience in being an operator. So
Absolutely, I think that makes sense. So I mean, I think it's really interesting that you came from like this journalist background and then sort of jumped obviously into more traditional corporate path. What unique skill sets do you think you got from like your journalism writing experience do you think that maybe give you an edge in these more traditional roles?
Yeah, I think beyond storytelling, right? I think, of course, that's one of the key skills, right? When it comes to storytelling, and in any facets of a business, you have to be doing storytelling, right? Especially when it comes to a consumer brand, I think, where how you synthesize or how you present the brand is so important. But also like when you're doing sales, right? So like when you're selling it to buyers or selling it to consumers or like selling it to other businesses, like that's very important. But I think one of the key skill sets of being an investigative journalist too, right, is that analytical component, right, where you're always seeking the truth. And I think that's something that I also learned a lot at Bridgewater, right, of like how important the truth is. And so I think that element of it, people sometimes forget, but I think it's a really important facet to like, you know, anything you do when it comes to business, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Like, just like ask the right questions.
Exactly.
And how was your experience at Bridgewater? I know it's a very high stress place, and I'm sure you learned a ton of skills that you use, you know, daily as a founder. What are the, you know, biggest skills that you learned that you use every day now?
Yeah, I mean, Bridgewater is a crazy place, right?
The radical transparency, the radical honesty thing. I mean, the culture's like wild.
Yeah,
the culture's wild. There's really no other place.
I mean, right, like, there's no other way to really sugarcoat it.
I don't even know how else to describe it, but like, there is no other place.
There's no other place like it. But I, you know, I think I was really I wanted to work at Bridgewater.
Okay.
Right? And like, I actively sought it out because.
Interesting.
I think for me, like, I am. How do I say it? I kind of feel like my whole life I'm like a what do you call it? Like a square peg in a round hole.
Okay.
Right. And I think that's, you know, one element of it. But the other element is that like, I'm very much like I'm a systems thinker.
Okay.
Right. Like, so I think of things in the like very big picture
like
way.
Operator. You're an operator.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with Ray and how Bridgewater is built, like that's such a big emphasis, right? That I felt at home, you know, when I got there. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's still an incredibly tough environment. And I think for me, like, I'm a very frank person, right? I'm very direct, right? I'm very like, you know, no BS. Like, I don't like to sugarcoat. I hate that, like, the compliment sandwich and like all those stuff. And Bridgewater is the opposite of that, right? It's all about radical transparency. It's all about like radical feedback. And like, you know, you have an iPad every day where like you're constantly rating each other, and like like translate into like your baseball card. So it's like, I don't know if you guys know about this.
Holy shit, this feels like a Black Mirror episode.
Doesn't it feel like a Black Mirror episode? I don't want to get in trouble for saying that, but like, it's, you know, that episode, it's, I think, very relevant to like my experience there, right? Where we have, you're basically rating each other all day, right? And the point there is that you find out the truth about yourself and how you show up to the world, right? And that type of feedback is so important to, I think, anybody.
Yeah.
Because there's very rare moments in time and like very rare circumstances and places where you're getting that feedback about yourself so directly. There's no guessing involved.
That's
immediately,
true.
Right? And you can track your performance. You can like really get a good picture of who you are. And I think there's that. And I think the other part about Bridgewater that really attracted me was the culture of excellence, right? And I think for me, early on in my career, I wanted to know what excellence really looked like. Like, that was important to me. And there's a, you know, in Bridgewater, there's all these, like, principles, right? And there's a big thing that Ray always emphasized. It's the danger of not knowing what you don't know. So I think that was such a key learning for me, because you can apply that to everywhere, right? Like, once you have that mindset of you don't really, there's a lot of things that you don't know, and that's one of the most dangerous things, then you know how to operate in that, right? So, like, for example, like, and it applies, I think I'm, you know, diverging a little bit, but it applies to like being an entrepreneur, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you know what good is and what excellence is, you will never know exactly how you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. And that real benchmark is where you should be striving for. So I think that's something that was really important to me that I learned from Bridgewater, right? And like the radical transparency and the radical feedback too.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's obviously a crazily unique experience to be a part of this also, but I will say Ray Donovan has created this like incredible, almost like cult-like culture, right, where people are like honestly really bought in to like what Bridgewater is and like this very unique way of thinking that's honestly disrupted like corporate reviews, etc. Do you want to create a culture similar to that? Are you bringing some aspects into it? Do you think there's some balance there? Like, how are you using that experience to create the culture of your firm and your company?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bridgewater has an incredibly unique culture, right? And a lot of people who, they say, like, a lot of people, like, you either last 6 months or you're there
Cat
and
life.
You cannot leave, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the one place you can be.
Yeah.
And it's such a unique environment. Do I want to replicate that? Probably not, right?
Just eliminates a lot of potential people, right?
Yeah, no, but beyond that, I think we also have a unique culture, and we're also at a moment where we're defining our culture, right? So there's, like, pockets of it that I really like think are incredible, like you know, the maybe not the radical transparency, but more about like the feedback culture, right? And the culture of excellence. I think that's one of the things that I really is so core to me and like has become such an important and integral part of me, right? It's this culture of excellence in everything that we do. So that translates to our product, right? Like product excellence, which I think is honestly a big thing and component that's missing in a lot of CPG companies and products out there is the most important thing to us, right? Mm-hmm. The excellence in innovation, the excellence in our brand, excellence in quality control, the excellence in our supply chain, in our ops, and everything, and the people that we hire. So I think that's something that I've, you know, absorbed from Bridgewater that I really brought over.
Yeah, I think that's very, yeah, that's important, like being a first-time founder, to really instill that kind of skill sets that you get from corporate. And you're not going to get that, you know, anywhere else, being, you know, just by yourself or working at like a less intense place.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that we've also found in our, like our founders that switch from consulting or finance. They have that foundation. They have that background to really, you know, solve problems and think on your feet and, you know, strive towards excellence, as you said. So super important. Okay, so you're at Bridgewater, and then you go to Estee Lauder.
Mm-hmm.
How was that switch? And then what were you also doing at Estee Lauder?
It was a tough switch.
Yeah,
yeah, that's so
could
different.
Not be more different.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it, I feel like that could really not tough. Be more
yeah,
different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the other side of the spectrum.
What? Like, yeah, yeah, like in every way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it was
different.
Like the complete opposite of what I could possibly do next, you know, which is like... so funny when I think about
it's
it.
It's like honestly super wild. Like yeah, I don't think we will ever meet anyone else who goes from Bridgewater to Estee Lauder. I honestly don't think that will ever exist.
It's so it's honestly like it's so funny because it went from like Bridgewater had a radical transparency culture, whereas like Estee Lauder is at its core driven by creatives. Right.
Yeah.
It's a love for consumer. It's a love for storytelling. It's a love for creative. It's a love for beauty. And that is just a completely different culture, right? When it comes to like creative versus a finance, it's just like, I don't know.
Cannot be like also like more... as masculine as possible to like as feminine
yeah,
as possible.
Exactly.
In my opinion, like you're like literally in like the most high pressure, intense, like kind of mean world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah,
into
yeah.
Like literally, I don't know. Now you're in like this completely different situation.
Yeah,
that's very,
yeah, exactly.
Like, feminine, aesthetic, yeah, creative, like
yeah,
soft touch.
Yeah,
right?
Like, yeah,
like no touch to like
yeah,
soft
yeah,
touch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
actually,
yeah,
you bring a good point. Like in at Estee, the most important value for us back then was or is high, being high touch.
Yeah,
right. Whereas Bridgewater, as you said, it's no touch.
No touch.
You know, so it's just so funny and like. You know, with Estee Lauder, it's so much about, like, the beauty of things, right? Yeah. The aesthetics and the creatives, where, like, for Bridgewater, it's not that it's not about that. It's just, like, different. But I think back then, like, what really attracted me, too, was, like, Estee Lauder was one of the best consumer companies out there, right? Yeah. Like, there are very few things or even brands in the world that is ubiquitously recognizable. And Estee Lauder was one of them. Right. And it was, and they have, you know, Estee Lauder come, you know, the whole background of the whole story of how Estee Lauder founded itself was incredibly inspiring as well. Right. So, you know, that jump was tough. And, you know, I had not been an operator before because I was, you know, at Kearney and then I was at Bridgewater. And then now I'm at Estee Lauder, where it's a huge machine. Right. And mm-hmm. It's products, like you're not making a software, you're making a physical product.
Yeah.
And that's so difficult. Right. Yeah.
So difficult.
So difficult.
You're dealing with consumers, people actually use your product every day.
Yeah.
Manufacturers.
Manufacturing,
vendors,
right? Manufacturing supply
yeah.
chain.
Yeah, exactly.
And so for me, like my role was I was part of the CEO's strategic initiatives team.
Cool.
So, you know, anything that was a high priority strategy that needs to be deployed. So we didn't just stay on like the strategic level, but we had to make sure that they were deployed in every one of our brands, every region, mm-hmm. every, you know, market. Right. And it was really challenging because Estee Lauder has a huge portfolio, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, hundreds.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Hundreds There's, of other brands,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's not just makeup and skincare. It's fragrance, it's hair care, it's home, right?
Yeah.
So it's just, it's a very complex portfolio. And when it comes to physical product, as I said, it's very, it's much more complex, right? So it's complex in a different way. So I think that was a challenging pivot for me. And that, you know, no touch to high touch thing was also like, it took me a second to be like, oh my God, like I cannot just be like this direct with everybody, right?
Like I can't just rate them because they
annoy me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are many times where I was like, oh my God, I just
like, I wish they had
right
the
now,
baseball
know?
Card.
I wish I had a baseball card that said like, this is
yeah,
like
who
like,
are you?
Like, yeah, she's like, a fucking bitch. Like,
yeah,
honestly,
exactly. Like,
you know?
I felt like I underappreciated, right? Because at Bridgewater, like before I meet someone, I pull out their baseball card. I knew exactly what they were going to be, right? Like, I know where they, like, are good at, where they're not good at, how they work in a team. But with Estee Lauder, it's like, who are you? Like,
yeah.
what do you do? Like, how do I work with you? You know, so it was definitely an adjustment period, but, you know, different worlds.
That's awesome. And obviously, I'm assuming you love being in the maybe retail space, consumer space. How did that sort of transition into starting your own company? How'd you think of Oddball? Where'd you go from there?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I might get some hate for saying this, but like, consumer is a woman's world.
It is.
Consumer is for women.
Hey, it is.
Yeah. But even at Estee, and I hate that I'm saying this, when I was there, like, most of the leadership is all men
which
still.
Which is crazy. Mm-hmm.
Which yep. is really crazy, right? Because it's yeah. a beauty company.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I think, like, you know, I think I'm deviating a little bit, but what really bothers me is that, like, consumer is so female-driven, right? The
Completely.
Users
99%,
are...
99%, yeah.
Yeah, are mostly women, right? And women are the ones that are making decisions for the household when it comes to a lot of consumer product. This is not, like, you know, of course... not trying to like just generalize everything.
No, but it's true. It's yeah. just factual. Yeah.
But a lot of the product that women use are still designed by men.
Which is crazy.
Yep. And it's not optimized for us, right? No. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, like that was a part of it, right? Like I didn't feel like the food was really designed for women.
Yeah.
And it wasn't satisfying what I needed, or it's more of like, I don't feel like I'm eating the right thing for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Totally.
So I think that was a big part of, distracted myself so much. I forgot what was
oh no you're
question
saying
about.
That inspired you to probably to start Oddball because you felt like there was maybe a female perception
yeah,
missing.
I think there's a lot of reasons why I started Oddball, right? But you know, a big reason was I always say like I'm just someone that loves junk food. Like I am one of those people,
yeah.
right? Like I eat a lot of like chips and Cheez-Its and Häagen-Dazs ice cream bars, and like, you know, just I just love eating junk food. And at a certain point, right, like I was like, oh my god, like I can't keep eating like this, right? Like I have stomach aches, like I have acne as an adult, right? Like yeah. I have my moods everywhere. So it's like taking a step back and being like, okay, I need to change how I eat. Mm. And then when I was looking for an alternative, right, because I don't know, like I'm not someone that can just go from like eating junk food and like my love for fast food, you know, I love Raising Cane's yeah. and, you know, McDonald's and stuff like that,
me
to
too.
Like not eating any of yeah. those
totally
things, right?
Like going cold turkey,
yeah,
that has
yeah.
to be a middle
like,
ground,
yeah,
right?
I love, I'm a foodie, I love food that tastes good,
yeah.
So when I was really trying to like find a replacement for all of that, I realized that like a lot of the food that I was seeing as replacements were what I consider as a catfish food. Now I made that turn up. Okay.
Yeah,
so,
I've
like,
never heard that. Yeah,
okay, you know, like,
what a
yeah.
catfish food is.
Well, you know what, like catfishing and dating.
Yeah, yes. for sure.
It's like when like someone like pretends. I don't know. Some like
yeah, they pretend to be someone they're
yeah,
not.
Like,
yeah,
like some 65-year-old man pretending to be Justin
yeah,
Bieber.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah
know,
totally.
Like,
different
yeah.
photos.
Yeah, same thing with food, right? So like, I am not satisfied by a protein bar just pretending to be a cookie. Like I don't think that tastes good. You know,
yeah.
it doesn't. Right? Like I don't. Like, I love cauliflower, but, like, when cauliflower is, like, pretending to be rice or pizza
yeah.
crust, like, I don't like that either, right? Mm-hmm. That's just me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's never going to be the same.
It's not the same.
It's literally
like,
not the same.
Yeah.
And, like, when you're really craving something and your body is really craving it, it's, like, actually makes you crave it more.
You just
yeah.
crave it more, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
I find myself eating,
like,
the real thing anyway.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Like, trying to eat a healthier substitute doesn't actually, like,
no.
satisfy. Mm-hmm.
And it actually satisfies nothing.
Satisfies
right?
nothing. Like, it makes you feel worse.
Yeah, it makes
yeah.
you feel
you
like
eat
shit.
More.
Yeah.
You eat more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
I just end up eating
anywhere.
The same
anyway.
Thing
yeah,
exactly.
Anyway, yeah.
So
exactly.
I'm just like, oh my god. What the fuck am I doing?
I got catfished.
Yeah.
So that is always how
I
feel about it. I got catfished.
They lied to me and said that this was the same.
Yeah.
I mean, I always feel that way. I mean, obviously social media and targeted ads are so bad, but like 100% of my targeted ads are literally just like targeted whatever reels are always like, oh, healthier version of brownies. And I'm like, I know that shit tastes bad. Like,
yeah.
you know what? Like when I see like
exactly.
that really hot, like, you know, like
yeah.
influencer,
I know
make,
exactly
like an aesthetic,
what you're talking
like
about. Yeah,
healthy
yeah.
brownie. And I'm like, that shit looks terrible.
It's probably like the same
yeah,
amount of calories or like,
it is.
Yeah. And
yeah.
I'm like, and I know it's not even good. And I'm like, I don't even think you eat this.
And
I
it's
think this
even
all
more
fake.
Ultra processed,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It's like,
which is worse, like having like, well, like processed, what it like processed sugar replacements are worse for you
yeah.
than pure sugar. And like butter replacements are worse for you than butter. Like,
yeah.
because even though there's maybe, like, a lower calorie count, you also can still gain fat from it, too, because of your body processes. But all is to say, all of these research, especially how women's bodies respond to a lot of these things, is very new.
Yes.
And especially, like, I feel like it's a very, very new idea of, like, how our hormones are imbalanced by a lot of these processed foods, and, like, men's hormones are so different. So basically, you're like, all this junk food is crap. There's nothing that I actually like. And I need to basically make something I can eat that's healthy-ish, but also satisfies me. I'm
yeah,
assuming, right?
I think you hit on a really good point, right? Like, back then, when I was thinking about all of this, which was like a couple years ago now, there was none of these terms, right? Yes. Like hormonal health, right? Correct. Like, and all those stuff. But it's funny because like I actually just spoke on a panel about hormonal health. I didn't create a product for hormonal health, but like I think back then the hormonal health now became the umbrella term of what I was feeling in my body.
Correct.
Right. So for me, it was really just like I couldn't understand or I couldn't fathom. If I'm someone that lives in New York City and I can afford, you know, a sweet green every day, right?
100%. And I still... you don't get Bridgewater. They give you free...
Exactly. I have free food. I have free food every day. But I still can't find something that, like, you know, I'm busy, right? Like, I'm, totally. I need something convenient. And I... Honestly, I am not the type that's working out 7 days a week. No. Right? Like, I'm not the type that's, like, counting my macros. I am not the type that's counting my calories. I just want something...
Yeah, you're like, I want something that I can buy. It doesn't make you
feel
like shit.
And I can trust, right?
And I can trust,
That it's a habit that I can build.
And I'll be, and you'd be a loyalist, I'm sure. You're like, I would be super loyal to it. You know, I would buy it every week.
Yeah.
You know?
So that was really the impetus of it and how the whole thing came about. Because, like, you know, I didn't think that I was going to become a traveling jello saleswoman, right? Like, that was not, like, in my, like, career path that I wrote out, right? But I think, like, for me, I really thought about how I grew up eating in Singapore and Hong Kong.
Okay.
And I think because I moved here and I assimilated into the culture and, like, I've been here for so long now, I just never left, right? So my diet also just changed without me realizing it.
Totally.
But when I took a step back, right, and I thought about, oh, my God, when I'm abroad or when I'm not in the U.S., I eat so differently.
Yeah.
Right? You don't need to go to Asia. You go to Europe, right? Like, everyone's like, oh, my God, I'm gluten-free. But, you know, in Europe, I can eat all the bread I want, right? And that's because, like, our food system and our food and the food laws are just so different in the U.S., right? Yeah. So in Asia, for example, we're governed by very simple food principles that was never, like, really, explicitly taught to us, right? But, like, just, like, you just grow up with it, right? Like, for example, like, we drink bone broth every night because it tastes good and it's good for you. It's not a fad, right? We eat fruit as our dessert. Fruit is a huge part of our diet. Yeah. So with snacking, for example, I was like, oh my God, all of our snacks are like based on real food, right?
Yeah.
Because I think like where I get tripped up is no hate on bars. I eat bars. But sometimes I'm like, what is this bar? Like, what is it actually? Yeah. Like, what am I eating?
What is
know?
It based off of?
Yeah, what is the actual like...
in it.
Yeah, and there's like 30 ingredients.
Yeah, it's the mass of it. You know, like what is like this gooey texture made of? So for me, it was just like, oh, in Asia, when we eat snacks, like it's always based on real food that's minimally processed, right? Whether it's seaweed or dried, like fruit, or like fruit is a huge part of snacking, right? Like dried seafood, etc. So that is a really basic concept that I wanted to bring here.
Yeah.
The concept of snacking on real food again.
Yeah.
Which seems so intuitive, but our food system is not built that way.
Right? No, it's not. I mean, American culture also in general, that is not how snacking is. I feel like honestly there is like in the zeitgeist, I feel like snacking is like kind of looked on as bad. Almost like snacking is seemed as like an indulgence, and I think that's how you, and so when you think of a snack you think of something unhealthy,
really tasty
like, right, like that is sort of the idea, versus I think obviously in other cultures a snack is like just another smaller meal.
It's crazy. Like, crazy. Just going back home, like, I grew up here all my life. Just going back home, you were just, like, eating fruit. And, like,
exactly.
Parents are giving you fruit. And, like, here, like, I'm, you know, eating chips or anything else that is unhealthy and, like, processed. But it's just, like, the culture. And, like, I'm, like, you know, moving less and eating more when I'm home. But, like, I feel better.
Exactly.
And I just feel healthier.
And fruit is your snack.
Yeah.
Fruit is your dessert and fruit is your snack. Because in Asian cultures, what I noticed, too, is your snacks are... probably gluten and dairy free and refined sugar free.
Yeah.
Because why do you need that for your snack, right?
Yeah.
And so what I, and here compared to here, I think your snacks are, it's typically what I call chemicals in a bag, right?
Yeah.
So I think that was really like, you know, the concept of going back to eating on real snack and snacking as a bad rep that I wanted to bring here. And for me, it was like, fruit is so underrated, right?
It is actually.
It's very underrated. And so that was how, you know, the concept of Oddball was born.
And then how did you land on jelly?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. It's a complicated answer, but I think for me, it was about being in fruit-based snacks. Because when I go home, when we're going to other people's houses, we bring a beautiful melon, right? Or like a bunch of grapes that has six juicy, ginormous, you know, like grapes, right? It's just like we bring beautiful fruits to each other's houses because fruit is such an important part of our diet. And I think that's something that I wanted to bring here, right? Because a lot of the fruit snacks here are just gummies.
Yeah,
it's just gummies. It's just candies, right?
Fruit snacks.
Or dried fruit that is has too much sugar that's pretending to be a gummy. So there's a double catfishing thing going on here. You know what I'm saying? So I think that that like made me think what type of snack I want. Because for me, I'm giving up a career in, you know, Bridgewater, Estee Lauder, right? So this is pretty high stakes for me. It's a big opportunity cost. So for me, it was about like, I didn't want to do another product that's already out there. I wanted to, if I was going to do something, it's got to be category defining, right?
Okay.
So for me, I wanted to do something that is a true innovation. With food is very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Especially snacks.
Especially snacks, because you're beholden to the food system that you're in.
Yeah.
So
and there's a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of stuff. It's very noisy.
There's huge conglomerates.
Yeah.
Exactly. So anytime you want to do something that's different from that, you're reinventing the wheel. But for me, it was a choice. So for me, I want to do something in the fruit snack space, but I knew it was really anchored around the idea of like snacking on real food. And because I come from consumer, right?
Yeah.
I knew that you have to start niche. Your product has to start niche for you to have a chance of survival. Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to be playing this like forever VC marketing funding game, right?
Correct.
So for me, it was about like, okay, how can I start a category defining brand that captures what I want to be in it, right? It's a real snack that's minimally processed, and it's about taking things out of our diet rather than adding things. Because every time you add, you have to add other bad stuff, right? But when you take away things, for us, it's very simple. It's about taking away all the bad stuff, preservatives, and refined sugar. That's it. It's very difficult. I thought about jelly because I actually thought it was, this is so weird and so funny, but when I first came to the US, like I thought it was so weird that when I went to college, that the only brand of jelly was Jell-O. Because nowhere else in the world eats Jell-O, right? You eat a different type of jelly, right? Jell-O became the brand and the category because it got so huge and has no competition. But if you look outside of the US, right? So like in Italy, you're eating panna cotta, right? In France, it's flan. Mm-hmm. In Singapore, it's agar. In Japan, it's kantan. So it's every culture has its own version of a jelly because jellies are very, very versatile food. And here, Jell-O has a bad rep because now it's like a hospital food. But think about why they serve it in hospitals.
Easy to eat, digestible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whatever sickness you have, whatever surgery you're getting, you can eat a jelly because it's digestible.
Correct.
So for me, it was about creating, because I think with our snacks, I think we're getting too niche, right? Mm-hmm. I wanted to create something that's truly a family snack. Anyone of all ages can eat this. I always call it no teeth to no teeth, right? From 0 to 100, you can eat it. Whatever diet you have, you can eat it. Whatever allergies you have, you can eat it. And jelly is low-key one of those foods. Yeah. And so for me, it was about seeing the opportunity of getting a niche category that's been so untouched, but so for me, so ripe for disruption and a good vehicle for the fruit, right? So that's how Oddball was burst, I guess.
That's incredible. Now that I like think about it, like it's literally just Jell-O that is in the US. And when I go home, obviously that doesn't exist. And there's so many other types of jellies that are way healthier. When you were ideating this product, you were still working full time, and like were you like experimenting different recipes in your home? How did you actually, you know, find Oddball?
Oh yeah. It was like, honestly, it was like a snowball effect, you know? Like I think people tend to think that, you know, when you go into entrepreneurship, you need to know exactly like the moment where you like jump in, when you have the product, when you have the idea, when you have like the conviction. But for a lot of us, it's not. For me, it wasn't, right? And I'll just be really honest, like I'm not American, right? I need a visa. I can't just quit my job to do something. So I needed to do it while like, you know, had my full-time job. And
yours is expensive too.
Yeah, it's expensive, right? It's opportunity cost. Yeah. Just like, you know, like I'm like, I like to take calculated risk, right? Like I'm not, I like to take risk, but I don't just take risk blindly.
Correct.
So for me, it was really like a snowball effect of like, at first I was just making something for myself, right? And then people started hearing about the idea, and then, you know, I brought like the chef heard about it, and so like he like helped me bring a product to life, right? And then this Kim, who's still with me today, heard about it and was like, oh my god, I can't believe no one's done it. So she helped me bring the brand to life, which still till today, right? From what she developed as a brand strategy, we never deviated from it. And we've evolved so much, right? So it was this step-by-step situation, and it honestly, for a longest time, it was just an idea. You know, it was just a deck, right? With like some, I don't know, pretty logo and like maybe like a few iterations of the product that we're just doing for fun. Until one day, I got contacted by the female quotient. fantastic organization, by the way.
What is that? I actually don't know what that is.
Yeah, so they're, I don't think I would have, I'm not the best way to describe them, but they're an organization that brings women together, and, like, I really, like, you know, I really owe it to them, right? Because they were looking, back then, they were looking for female founders to feature at the Super Bowl.
Cool.
Oh, specifically, like, female founders in food, right? And back then, like, we had nothing. And I hope they don't hear this right now. We had, like, no website. We had no Instagram. We had no product. We had no packaging. But I was like, I can't miss this opportunity, yeah, sure, right? Like, it was Taste of the NFL. It was a perfect event. It was hosted by the Super Bowl every single year before.
Wow.
And so I was like, we got to do it. And so in a week, we got everything together.
Wow.
Yeah, we got our packaging. Like, it was kind of janky. I was, like, you know, ironing the lids myself. Like, you know, Tanner, my husband, was, like, helping me with it. And then, you know, we, like, kind of painstakingly got the 200 cups together of Oddball. And that was the first time anyone has ever tried it.
Wow.
So I was super nervous. But you had to get through these humps, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, these are the humps where, with a consumer brand, it's so easy for you to just be in your head about it, because it's a version of you that you're putting out to the world. So,
also, Carrie, not everyone's, like, gonna like it. I think with anything,
of course, too. No one, even some, chocolate.
Like, right? People have different tastes. It's people, just different.
Exactly. With chocolate, no one, not everyone likes chocolate, yeah, right? So I carried this 80-pound box this big, right? Like, back then, we had no money to, like, ship it, because it was, like, $1,000 to ship. So I carried it to the plane with me.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, you know, we got there, and that was when it really was a huge unlock for me, because the first, like, 50 people who tried Oddball were all NFL athletes, which is so random.
Wow.
They're not even our target audience, right?
Yeah. No.
But I saw them coming back, pulling their friends to eat it. They were eating six at a time, and I was like,
they are health conscious, though.
They're health conscious.
Extremely health
conscious. They're health conscious.
And probably want a snack and eat a lot.
Exactly.
They need, like, also something quick. They travel a lot. Mm. They're busy. So, yeah. Honestly, maybe kind
of. I wasn't, I'm not an athlete myself, right? So, like, I wasn't creating for that group of people, but it resonated with them.
Yeah.
And I saw, like, actually people, like, eating multiple of them at a time, right? So then it was when I was like, that's my first signal, you know? So from there on, it was a lot of this, like, that helped me put us out there, right? So now I know, like, we can just, like, make it in our kitchen and, like, sell it in farmers market. So for a while, we were just selling them at the farmers market and getting traction that way.
Okay. So you were literally making it in
your
home.
Kitchen?
Yeah.
With what, like, a blender? What do you even make jelly with?
I don't know. So that's a good question. So
like how do you make it? Like, what is it? I feel like it's pretty hard to make.
Yeah. It's one of those products where, like, you cannot really just make it in a kitchen.
Yeah,
it's very sciencey.
It's very sciencey.
Yeah, I'm thinking like Jello shots. Like,
It's very, like, sciencey.
It also can fall apart easily.
Yeah.
A lot of things can go
the
wrong.
The texture goes wrong
the
really.
The texture you have, the ingredients are probably, like, kind of weak.
Yeah.
Hard to source.
Yeah, exactly.
Like maintaining it.
Yeah, it's not just like making, like, I don't know, something that you can typically make in a kitchen, right?
Yeah.
But I was really lucky back then where I had a really talented R&D chef who was working with me and developing this. So he was making it, not me.
Okay, so he had like an actual industrial kitchen or something.
No, we had like a small like commercial kitchen.
Okay.
And we had, you know, like a small sealer and a blender. But like for the longest time, we were just like literally ironing with an iron because we had no money for anything else, you know, because this is one of those products where you need the equipment and it takes CapEx, right? And it takes scale and it takes scientists to do. So it's a scale product. But in the beginning it was crazy.
How long did it take you to get to a recipe you liked? What was the process of that?
Probably took 2.5 years.
Wow. Damn.
Thousands of iterations.
Were you working with the chef originally or how did that kind of come about?
Yeah, so I was trying to do it on my own, honestly. Again, I was just making a product for myself, to be honest, and you know, seeing if other people like it. I came across a chef who was an incredibly talented, you know, he had a Michelin star chef, like he's incredible. But eventually it got to a point where it needed a lot of science behind it, right? And it got to a point where I felt like we had enough indications and signals and traction for me to go raise around and bring in an R&D house, right?
Yeah.
And so again, like I keep emphasizing our emphasis on product excellence. And for a product like this, it was really easy to cave because everyone is telling you just to add whatever, right? Like a sweetener, just to add stevia, just to add like, you know, preservatives, just to add, you know, whatever. And every no you say adds a year worth of work, right? Or a month's worth of work. So it was an incredibly challenging process because you're walking that tightrope of a line of when you say no to something, and when you're building a new product, you do not have a previous version to be basing yourself off of, which means you don't know if it's actually possible to make. And that's the most difficult hump to get through as a new brand, right? Is if you're bringing out an innovative product, is this really possible? How much can you push your team to get what you want? So that was a really long process, and it took thousands of iterations to get to where we are today.
Wow. I mean, how do you, I mean, just from a practical perspective, not having any preservatives is really hard, right?
Very hard.
The reason why the U.S. has so many preservatives in our food is because the U.S. is so big, right? And effectively, like, traveling produce from one place to another is impossible if you do not have any preservatives in any sort of fresh food, and also effectively makes grocery stores unable to operate, right? Because basically the shelf life isn't long enough. So that's why we have so many preservatives in our food and other countries do not, just because of our large size and the travel and that complication. Otherwise, 90% of the U.S. would have no access to produce, right? So it's unfortunate reality of just where we are. But how are you able to, like, maintain the shelf life of, like, this fruit-based product? And even do D2C without any preservatives.
Yeah, it's that was the biggest thing for us to solve for, right? I knew that for this company to succeed, it needed to be shelf-stable-ish, right? While maintaining the integrity of the product. But I was so gung-ho about not adding preservatives, we had to solve it via other ways, right? Yeah. So for us, it's our process. And that is, like, honestly, it's a trade secret for us. So, like, I can't talk about it that much, but you have to be innovative in other ways, right? So, like, our packaging, for example, right? Like, we have pretty much just one type of packaging that we can use. It's a high barrier cup that protects the product. And I think, like, when it comes to food, it's really about giving and taking. Yeah. So it's not going in extremes, right? And finding exactly that, as I said, that tightrope of a line that you're walking of, I can give this up and I can give that up, right? So, for example, I can give up 3 years of shelf life, right? But I need at least 6 months ambient shelf life.
For sure.
Right? I need at least 1 year of refrigerated shelf life. That I can give up. I cannot give up zero shelf life, but I can give up 3 years and I can walk in the middle. So I think a lot of what food is about the compromises and making the right compromises, right? Yeah. I don't want added sugar, right? I don't want, but I'm okay with having, like, you know, 9 grams of sugar. I just don't want, you know, the sugar alcohol or the fake sweeteners. Mm-hmm. But that's a choice that we made, right? Not everyone is going to be okay with it. A lot of people tell us, no, just add, like, you want to have the 0 grams of sugar in your packaging. But I'm like, no, because if I were a mom, I don't want to feed my kids stevia.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, 100%. Also, I mean, there is also so much new research about, like, the food that we eat as a child. Obviously, like, really determines our taste palate as an adult, so.
Exactly.
Which I'm sure is new. Okay, so basically, you're able to innovate in other ways to protect. Are you in the refrigerated aisle? Is that where you are? Or are you in the snack aisle?
It depends on which retailer we're going into. So, Sprouts specifically, and shout out to Sprouts. They've been, like, incredible partners to us. We are going into the refrigerator aisle, right? Yeah. So because I think our product requires consumer education.
Yeah.
We did a consumer panel and it was split between whether people wanted to find us in, would expect to find us in, you know, the snack aisle or the refrigerator aisle. But I think ultimately, like, I chose to be in a refrigerator aisle because our strategy is natural in the beginning. And I think that's just, like, a better space, right? Mm-hmm. It's a more premium space. It's better for us to tell our brand story in the beginning. And then eventually we can move into the ambient shelf.
I mean, it feels like yogurt to me. Sort of like the, like, is that where you're trying to kind, I mean, I feel like it doesn't really feel like Jell-O because Jell-O is associated with, like, not being healthy and kind of a dessert for
It's not.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I feel like I think about, like, chocolate pudding snacks as, like, a kid. And they were considered dessert.
Yeah.
And not healthy. But this is obviously, like, a healthy snack that you can carry. It feels like yogurt to me.
Yeah, I think it has similar eating occasions as a yogurt. I'm lactose intolerant, so, like, I don't eat yogurt. Yeah. So I think that's also part of the reason why I'm just like, oh my God, like, yogurt is a really good example of, like, a fresh snack, right? Yeah. Of, like, a real snack, but it's just yogurt, right? Like, it's 5,000 options of yogurt and, like, I can't really eat that.
Correct.
So I think for me, it was important to mirror that success of yogurt, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, like, I think one of the brands that, like, I look up to a lot is Chobani.
Yeah.
And I think you really hit the nail on the head, whatever that saying is. Yeah. All these, like, phrases I never know. I'm like, ugh. But yeah, you know, like, what Chobani did was incredible because people didn't know this. But before Chobani started, yogurt was incredibly niche, right? Yes. It was a diet food, and it was in, like, a tuckaway aisle, and it was not common.
Yeah.
What Chobani did so well is it reintroduced yogurt to Americans,
yes.
right? It took it from the diet aisle to the dairy aisle, made it a breakfast food, made it a dessert, made it a snack, right? And introduced that premiumness via the Greek yogurt.
Yeah.
So it's a similar thing that we're doing here, where we're reintroducing a category that is a little bit forgotten, not forgotten, but just dusty. Yeah. So
totally.
Yeah.
For us, right, is we always say, like, we're not trying to be a better for you Jell-O.
We're just a new category.
We're an oddball, right? That's why we're called oddball. We're an oddball. And honestly, if anything, this is what Jell-O should have been from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's fascinating, because, like, you're reinventing the category, and it's not...
As it should be.
And
the food cup category.
I feel like creating a new one, honestly. Because it's, like, actually healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, at least, like, me, like, growing up in the U.S., like, Jell-O is not considered healthy.
It's considered dessert.
And actually, like, back in the day, like, in this, like, when, like, our parents were kids in the U.S., like, it was a very American dessert to make homemade Jell-O. I don't know if you've ever seen those, like, where you take the little pan or whatever.
Yeah, it was
a really popular, like, 70s dessert.
Yeah.
It was, like, a thing. Like, lime Jell-O was a thing.
Yep.
And then it kind of, like, died out with the trend or whatever. But it is, I think it's actually a brand new category.
It's just a new category, right? Yeah. We are category creators, and... What we're also close, I think we're closer to a fruit cup. Remember the dough fruit cup?
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
But like our texture is so similar to Jell-O that like people, like the first thing that people say is, oh, it's a healthy Jell-O, right? But it's actually closer to a fruit cup in terms of the ingredient simplicity.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah, but it's oddball.
Yeah.
It's a thing of its own.
I guess on that note, like, how has it been, and what's been the biggest challenge of convincing consumers to try something new?
Yeah. No, I think for us, like, our feedback has always been really strong, right? Like, we, on day one, we're launching into nationwide retail, right? Which is very rare for a small brand. And so there's clearly a white space there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think there's clearly, you know, demand for it. And, you know, the reason why we're even as far as, we're not far at all, like, we're just starting, but, like, the reason why I decided to do this, right, was because when I was doing all these farmers market tests, and it's a really rare moment in time, because even when you're in, you know, national retail and stuff, like, you're not seeing your consumers that often, right? Whereas in farmers market, like, you can see how people are interacting with your product. Yeah. And that's very, very important.
And you're getting feedback.
Yeah.
Real
like
time.
And it's also just, like, listening to what they say in between the lines, right? Like, I could tell that people wanted to be eating real food, but, like, they don't realize, like, or they wanted more fruits, right? They want to eat more fruit. They want it more, like, of that refreshingness. The refreshingness comes from eating real food, you know? So, like, it's reading up in between the lines. So, like, I think for us, our reaction, our, you know, our traction has always been people are very excited about it. And then your other question was, like, what's been the biggest challenge?
Mm-hmm.
I think that CPG is very complex, right? It's not complicated. It's complex. Mm-hmm. So, your margins are so thin that you cannot make that many big mistakes. You really cannot make that many mistakes, right? So especially when we took a big bet, right? You know, like a typical brand path is you're going D2C first, right? And maybe going to, like, you know, a handful of bodega, then going to regional, like, say, like, a regional Whole Foods or whatever, and then you go into national, right? So, like, for us to take that leap to go into national was a huge bet that we took on ourselves. And that required expertise, right? That means you had to build out your entire infrastructure for scale, right? That's very different than just going to D2C, right? Because, like, you had to build an entire system to get to all these stores.
Also nationwide.
And nationwide.
And a product doesn't have a full shelf life.
Exactly.
That needs to be refrigerated. That probably has different flavors.
Yep.
Complex manufacturing.
Very complex manufacturing, very complex supply chain, very complex logistics. Everything is complex. Hiring, right?
Yeah.
Hiring is very difficult when it comes to consumers.
I mean, do you have to figure out travel? You have to figure out, I don't even know. Trucks?
Like shipping.
Yeah, shipping, freight, right? Logistics is, CPG is an operations game.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is the biggest challenge, right? Is finding the right people who have done this before to do it well the first time because of, you know, the scale of our launch, right? The other thing is getting consumers to try a new product.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because consumers don't like to try new things.
Yeah.
But they sometimes do. So I think it's, like, for us, it's overcoming the hurdle of, like, helping consumer understand what this is.
Yeah.
Because it's so new.
Is there, like, an education component with the marketing that you've been doing? Just because I know this is, like, rooted in your childhood overseas. So, like, how have you been educating the consumers?
I mean, we have done barely any marketing so far. We're still, you know, transparently, we're still waiting for our reset to completely be reset. And, you know, we're out of stock online. So there's very little marketing that we do. Because when you market, you have to make sure that you have
enough
inventory.
For people to buy, right? Otherwise, it's just like lost dollars.
Yeah. Also, they'll be angry. They're like, you marketed this to me and I can't buy
it. Exactly.
Like,
and then you get pissed off, right? And you lose the consumer.
You just don't go
back. Exactly. Yeah. So, but for us, like, it's a lot of emphasis on the use occasion. Right, because you need to help consumers like get there to visualize like, oh, this is something that I could put in my kid's lunchbox every day.
Yep.
This is something that's great for a pre or post workout, right? As a woman, because you're looking for something light to eat, it's low calorie, right? It's great as like a replacement for ice cream, right? It's just educating these use occasions, and we do it via like, you know, social media, right? Like that is like in one way or another, like probably the cheapest way to scale, and we do it via UGCs and micro affiliates. So that's like, you know, by far, probably like our most important strategy.
Okay. Yeah,
makes sense.
Do you think, I mean, it is, I will say, obviously retail environment, incredible, right? I mean, it makes so much sense for your product, but it also is sometimes is harder to get a consumer to try something new in a grocery store. How do you think you're kind of combating that? Just like why, you know, are you doing anything in terms of like consumer behavior tracking of like the location of where it is or doing any sort of local, like, you know, at the end of the aisle taste test at different Sprouts or anything like that?
Yeah. So I actually would say, we went through a period where everyone thought that all food is bought online, but that's not true, right?
Yeah, no.
It's not.
No, it's not.
Like, no one is, like, most people don't go on dumpling.com to go buy dumplings, right?
Yeah.
They don't go on jelly.com to buy jelly.
Right.
Like,
no, most people go to the grocery store every week.
Go to the grocery store, and it's supplemented by Instacart, Amazon, and a bunch of other places, right? Like,
correct.
Once in a while, you just discover something on D2C.
Yeah.
If it's super enticing, right? And like, even then, like, it's very... Like,
it needs to be part of your routine. It needs to be on Instacart.
Yeah, exactly. It needs to be on the platforms where people are used to buying online grocery, right? That's Fresh Direct, that's Instacart, that's like Imperfect Foods, etc. So we have a strategy that's more geared towards that, right? Versus our own website. In regards to retail is still the place where people are discovering food, I believe.
Okay.
Right? So I think, and that's in conjunction with an Instacart or like an online platform.
Yeah, totally.
Because you have to remember, I'm a foodie, but for most people, grocery shopping is a chore.
Yeah, right? And it's like routine.
It's a routine, right?
Especially like I'm thinking like family vibe, like whatever. Normal mom with two kids going in.
You're busy,
she goes in every Sunday at 2 and she buys her same 10 things and she gets the F out, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So how do you make her stop and change her routine?
So the most important for us and our, you know, priorities are and sexy marketing stuff, right? It's shopper marketing.
Yeah.
Before that, you have to make sure that like your P's are good, right? Your price, your placement, you know, like all those, your packaging. That's your packaging is your biggest marketing billboard. Where you're placed in a shelf is your biggest marketing billboard. How you're priced. So those are the fundamental things that you have to get right first, right? Then you can think of the next level. You always want to be closest to point of sales, right?
Okay.
So this is promos, not sexy, right? Demos, not that sexy, right? And then it's Instacart ads, right? So things that are like driving ROI that are not sexy first.
Yep.
And then you think about the brand because you had to be doing both. But you had to make sure that like in the beginning, your marketing spend is leaning towards these unsexy, like, you know, shopper marketing, trade marketing things versus the brand marketing things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
How do you land on Sprouts as a partner? Were you looking at other retailers?
Yeah, so actually, how this all got started was because I entered a pitch competition at Fairway.
Oh
really?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I love Fairway because
Fairway
is like my local grocery, right?
Yeah,
and
for sure.
When I realized that like they wanted us, I was like, oh, like we can actually like scale faster than I think we can.
So you weren't even thinking of going straight to
I was thinking of going to like Fairway
local.
Was great because it was regional.
Yeah.
You know, it was part of ShopRite. Like it was, you know, a manageable scale and it was not small. Like it was not big, but not small. So it was like good in between. And so, but because of that, it made me realize the product just like needed to be at that next level, right? If I was just going into bodegas, I wouldn't mind having a 1 month shelf life. Getting to that 6 months ambient shelf life was very challenging.
Sure.
So then that gave us the resources and the ability to raise to get us to the next level product wise.
Okay.
Once that product got to the next level, obviously, I was really grateful to Sprouts, not Sprouts, to Fairway. But I love entering these competitions. So I entered a competition for Sprouts' innovation set.
Okay.
So Sprouts, what they're known for is they are known for bringing a lot of unique innovations into the stores. That's why their shoppers go there.
Yeah.
And they have this, and a typical way a new brand gets into Sprouts is, you know, they go through this innovation program where they, you know, out of like, I think 10,000 applicants, they select 30. Then they put you in this rotation for a month or 3 months. And then from the 30, I think they select like maybe three to do
like
a regional launch.
For food.
Exactly.
I love that.
Yes. So I was pitching for that. But what happened was that my category buyer walked past. And when he saw the product, he was like, oh my God, I've been looking for something like that for the past 12 months. And I asked every brand to make me that, wow. But no one can make it because it's so hard to make.
It's so hard to make.
Yeah.
Well, it is high barrier to entry.
Yeah.
It is a high, it has a stronger moat, right?
Yeah.
So, and they were just like, yeah, we want this right now. And I was like, innovation or like in line? And they were just like, yeah, we want this right now in line. And that was it.
Wow.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's incredible.
That's awesome.
I feel like that's like not heard of for a small.
No, I mean, I've never heard of it.
Yeah.
Unless
CPG.
You're like a celebrity
right,
brand.
Right,
yeah.
Right,
so
right.
That was it was a huge decision for us to make because I think for me, it's about, I'm good with taking risks, right? But like when you take risks, you have to make sure that you are at that level.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning
you're prepared.
You cannot just go into Sprouts, right? You need to make sure you have the right funding, you have the right team, like the right systems, the right processes and the right product. So yeah, that was the Sprouts moment for us.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, this goes back to like the culture of excellence you were talking about.
Exactly.
All of your like experiences, you're able to deal with funding, you're able to do, you know, branding, marketing, and like manufacturing, like everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that's a great culmination. And congrats again on launching.
Thank you. Or launching.
Launching.
Not launching. And you've raised a round. You're raising another round. What are next steps for you?
Yeah, so next step is really driving velocity, right?
Okay.
I think crushing Sprouts is the most important thing for us right now, and, you know, raising our next funding, et cetera. And really just getting our, I call this like, this is the refining stage, right? And I think this stage where you're post-launch, but pre-traction, right? Like pre-real traction, this is the most fragile part of founding a company.
Yeah.
So it's a high stakes, high pressure, but exciting phase, right? So for us, it's about refining everything, right? Like from our packaging to our messaging to our brand and, you know, our placements, making sure that, like, you know, it's a machine that's getting going, hiring, expanding, and then unlocking the next phase of growth.
Yeah. Well, we're so excited,
to
see you guys grow.
Yeah.
I guess one last question before we wrap up. What is a piece of advice that you'd give to an aspiring entrepreneur?
I think I have two. One is, I think right now entrepreneurship is very sexy. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's like eating glass every day.
Oh
my gosh. That is what, like, you know.
You're so honest.
Yeah, I'm very honest.
Well, that was a metaphor.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, and I didn't make this up, right? Like, an entrepreneur who, someone I highly respect, like, who's also an investor, his name is Garrett. He's the founder of Handshake. You know, Handshake's, you know, a unicorn now, but that's what he told me, right? Being an entrepreneur is eating glass every single day.
Wow.
And he is, for the scale that he of success that he's achieved, like, he's still saying that, right? So, like, I think that's just something that you need to realize, that it's really tough.
Yeah.
And I think it's also really important that you really are solving for a problem, right?
Yeah.
You're not just bringing something to the world that is just made for you, right? That you're, like, really solving a problem, because, and I'm trying to tie this all together, right? But if you know you're solving for a problem and you have conviction that you are, right? And that you know that that's what you're bringing to the world, then it makes eating glass every day okay, you know, ish. But if you're not, it makes it really hard to sustain. So that's one advice I have. And the second one I have is just, you know, if you're coming from corporate to entrepreneurship, like, there's no avoiding the feeling of jumping off of the cliff, no matter how prepared you are. So just do it if you have the itch. So
that's
great.
Amazing. I love that. Well, jump off a cliff and eat
and
glass
eat
every
glass.
Day. Good team.
Really off this,
but okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on to me. This is awesome. We're so excited to see Oddball grow. Obviously, you're on Sprouts. Where can we find you on socials and etc.?
Yeah, follow us on oddball.world.
Okay.
And we're also live online as well, so you can buy us on www.oddball.world. Can give you guys a code as well.
Great.
And then very soon for New York, you can probably find us soon in Fresh Direct and Fairway.
Amazing.
And a few other places. So
that's
great.
Incredible. Thanks so much for coming on. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. Eat Oddball and also reach out to us as always if you have any questions for us or Sophia on womensplainpod1@gmail.com and womensplainpod on all the socials. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.